Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page with the headline for the cover story, North Carolina's Best-Run Public Companies. Mergers, acquisitions, profits, and a nose for managing expenses reflect the list of the best-run publicly traded corporations in North Carolina. And that's the headline on the front page. The article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline. North Carolina's best-run public firms, profits, planning, management effectiveness, and shareholder returns rise to the top in determining this exclusive list of successful performers. And this article is written by Cameron Snipes. The Triangle may not be in a position to claim to have many high-powered corporate headquarters in its backyard, but the community can take pride in the fact that some of the best-run public companies in the state call the Raleigh-Durham area its corporate home. Why does that matter? Millions of dollars in vending and procurement opportunities are largely dependent on the fiscal soundness of the state's largest corporate institutions. If they fare poorly in managing and running their businesses, the down effect is felt squarely on small businesses that provide products and services to these companies. But if they do well, opportunities arise for new work that lifts the entire local economy. An analysis of the fiscal strength, management effectiveness, and shareholder returns of North Carolina public companies reveal that the Triangle has the lion's share of companies in the top 25 of the rankings. The rankings included factors such as one-year change in revenue, share price and employee count, and an efficiency quotient, which considered the ratio between net income and operational expenses. The overall average rank of the individual metric rankings resulted in a list that we're calling North Carolina's Best-Run Public Companies. As an additional element, the review also looked at the return on assets, ROA, and return on equity, ROE, for selected local companies mentioned in the list. Greg Brown, a finance professor and executive director of the Keenan Institute for Private Enterprise at UNC Chapel Hill, assisted Triangle Business Journal in this effort. Overall, it's a pretty reasonable ranking, Brown says. If you take the ranks and the average of those ranks, you do end up with better data versus straight percentages. There are 6 different industries represented by the 11 local companies in the top 25. Life sciences and banking finance make up the largest representation, followed by technology, utilities, construction, and insurance. That industry diversification serves as a pronounced theme throughout the state. Best in the state. Let's take, for instance, North Carolina's 5 best performing public companies in 2015. In that microcosm alone, 3 different industries are represented: financial services, life sciences, and tobacco manufacturing. The top 25 is made up of 11 different industries from various parts of the state, including Raleigh, Charlotte, Winston-Salem, Wilmington, and Burlington. According to the analysis, the top performing company in the state in 2015 was Charlotte financial services firm LendingTree Incorporated. Its price share over the course of the year rose nearly 90% and currently trades around $99, more than a 40% increase in its overall employee roster, and a 52% increase in total revenue from 2014 to 2015 were the other major contributors to its number one ranking. Moreover, when it comes to LendingTree's ROA and ROE, both numbers showed solid returns. The company's ROE was 21.3%, and its ROA clipped the 17% mark. Tobacco manufacturing company Reynolds snagged the number 2 spot, buoyed by a high operational efficiency quotient, which is designed to measure the amount of profit derived from the total number of dollars spent. Top Triangle performers. Topping the Triangle list and number 3 overall was Inc. Research, a Raleigh-based contract research organization. The company's share price rose 95% in 2015, beginning to end, making it the second highest price jump in the state. Inc.'s ROE was at the top with almost 54%. and it turned in an ROA of nearly 10%. Our 2015 success was following what was laid in prior years, says Jamie McDonald, Inc.'s CEO. We progressed on the business we won and the contracts we entered into, and we received revenue from that. Operationally, we were more efficient and at the same time, were making investments into the company. Inc. filed for the public markets in November 2014 and was, up until recently, considered a controlled company per NASDAQ rules. The company's major shareholders were Avista Capital Partners, LP, and affiliates of Ontario Teachers Pension Plan, which combined to hold 53% of the outstanding shares. In the most recent deal, the two entities plan to sell 6 million of those shares and, as a result, will own less than 50% of its shares. Inc.'s employee count is up about 1,000 from the end of 2014, and revenue for 2015 is up nearly 20% from last year. The other Triangle-based company in the top five on the statewide list is Raleigh's Yatkin Financial. The two main drivers of the bank's solid showing was its operational efficiency rank and its nearly 35% increase in total revenue from 2014 to 2015. The year 2015 was a busy one for Yatkin as it further built its brand, and it announced in October that it was buying Greensboro-based Newbridge Bank. The move pitted Yatkin against BNC Bancorp for the title of largest community bank in North Carolina. A month later, BNC, ranked in a tie for third place overall on the best-run list, announced it was buying High Point Bank. Worst-performing local companies. While there were several bright spots among the best-run list, there are also a few companies on the flip side of that coin. UNC's Brown cautions that industry and or company-specific issues can certainly affect a company's yearly performance, and thus its overall ranking to this list. Such was the case at Durham-based Cree. Cree's share price fell nearly 17%, and the employee count dropped more than 10% in 2015. A large contributing factor to that less-than-stellar showing was its fiscal fourth-quarter loss of $88 million. That loss came in a quarter that saw $84 million in changes from an already-announced LED restructuring plan that will mean consolidation in Durham, though the firm has yet to be specific on headcount impact. Pretty much anyone in LEDs in Q4, it was a pretty challenging environment, Chuck Swoboda said at the time. As for management effectiveness, year over year, ROE and ROA have both taken a beating. 2 years ago, the Durham company's ROA was 2.85%. Today, the ROA has dropped to negative 2.3%. ROE numbers reflect similar drops from 3.1% to negative 2.7% today. Youngsville-based woven fabrics and paper products manufacturer Zerium Technologies was another poor performer in 2015, a year that produced declines in net sales and production plant closures. Zerium CEO Harold Beavis has been leading an effort to reposition the company after it emerged from Chapter 11 bankruptcy about 3 years ago. Since he took over in 2012, Zerium has closed 8 of its plants, shifting the company's focus to more profitable markets. And also with this article, there are quite a few graphs involved laying out the numbers, but we'll look at a couple of them. First, the a box that's titled Methodology. How was the list determined? With assistance from the Keenan Institute of Private Enterprise at UNC Chapel Hill, Triangle Business Journal's ranking was comprised of 4 main factors: percentage differences in share price from the first day of trading to the last day in calendar year 2015, annual 2015 revenue change compared to 2014, employee count in 2015 compared to 2014, and an operational efficiency quotient, the result of 2015 net income divided by 2015 operational expenses. The average of each of these factors was calculated, and the sum of those averages was ranked again to determine the final list. List was researched by Jim Buse, Amy Shapiro, and Cameron Snipes. And to give you the full list, we'll do a countdown of the top 25, and this will be the average rank Taking four factors into account, the ranks of the best-run companies were developed by using the average of the overall score. At number 25, Investors Title Company. 24, Haynes Brands Incorporated. 23, Carlisle Companies. Tied at 21, Martin Marietta Materials Incorporated and BB&T Corporation. At number 20, Quintiles. 19, Power Secure International Incorporated. 18, Home Trust Bank Shares Incorporated. 16, tied at 16, First South Bancorp Incorporated and PRA Health Sciences Incorporated. 15, Primo Water Corporation. Tied at 13, Coca-Cola Bottling Company Consolidated and Carolina Bank. 12, Triangle Capital Corporation. Tied at number 10, Select Bancorp and Sempra Incorporated. At number 9, Laboratory Corporation of America. Number 8, Red Hat Incorporated. 7, Live Oak Bank Shares. 6, Integra Financial Corporation. 5, Yatkin Financial Corporation. Tied for number 3, BNC Bancorp and Inc. Research Holdings Incorporated. Number 2, Reynolds American Incorporated. And number 1, LendingTree Incorporated. And now we'll turn to the Viewpoint page, because on the Viewpoint page, the Editor's Notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, who is editor of Triangle Business Journal, has the headline, Understanding Our Best-Run Companies List. Over the years, readers of this paper have seen us do several lists across different industries and specialties to get a broad idea of size, scope, and longevity of our corporate class. But what you see in this week's cover story is markedly different and relevant if you are looking to do business in the Triangle. Thanks to some assistance from Greg Brown, who heads the Keenan Institute of Private Enterprise at UNC Chapel Hill, we looked at how the largest public companies are run and whether some of them simply are more efficient than others, regardless of their industry bucket. What we found was quite interesting. Perhaps more importantly, if you want to do business with any of these large public companies in the state, these financial numbers spread across the pages of this week's paper may offer you a blueprint to your talking points when selling your product and services. From the list, after considering the four primary year-over-year comparison factors, share price growth, revenue growth, operational efficiency, and employee count, it was clear that the large and mid-sized financial services firms in North Carolina had a good year. They managed their money well. They bought new companies that increased their sizes, and share prices jumped during the year, especially after an anemic 2014. About 11 of the top 25 best-run companies in North Carolina were in the financial services field. Healthcare services was next, with 5 companies. In order to get a better understanding of the Triangle companies, we also checked the return on equity and return on assets of our local companies. The ROE and ROA often are considered benchmarks for management effectiveness. In the end, a public company CEO always has to answer to his or her board about that number, and they often lose their jobs if that number does not improve. Raleigh's Inc. Research fared well, and as CEO, Jamie McDonald opines, the clinical research organization is close to firing on all cylinders. Interestingly, ROA leader Quintiles did not even make the top 25 local ROE list. That will not make shareholders happy. For companies at the bottom of the ROE and ROA list, 2016 likely is going to be a very critical year. The numbers have to improve for shareholders' sakes, and it has to come through efficiencies. Manage your expenses well by spending money on things that give you the best chance of improving your top line. That, in turn, will boost your net income as long as your other line items, such as SG&A, are under control. We will improve on this list every year by adding additional factors in the coming year. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, this week written by web editor Mark DeRoberts. The first headline, Eshelman's Positive Outlook on Valiant. Talk about a local exec all over the drama being played out with Valiant Pharmaceuticals. The founder of two important North Carolina companies, PPD and Furiex, Fred Eshelman says he accepted a board position at Valiant Pharmaceuticals International in part simply because Bob Ingram asked him to, but also because he thinks the company will come out of the other side successfully. This is going to be one of the ultimate big turnaround stories down the road, Eshelman says. About a month ago, Eshelman joined the Valeant board with former UNC System President Tom Ross. The pharmaceutical giant bought Raleigh-based drug companies Salix Pharmaceuticals and Sprout Pharmaceuticals, but have gone through management troubles, accusations of fraud, and most recently, a notice of default because it delayed filing its 2015 annual report. CEO Michael Pearson has said he will step down. Eshelman tells Biz he has a high opinion of the company, saying things would get better. It's a solid company. It's just a matter of getting through all the junk that's going on right now. With Ingram and Eshelman shepherding the board, Valeant may have a chance of coming out of this mess. Hall of Fame calls on Erica Braun. Biz was surprised this has not happened yet. Raleigh's Golden Corral Corporation executive, Erica Braun, recently received some good news. She's being inducted to the North Carolina Swimming Hall of Fame on April 29 in Greensboro. Braun joins standout NC State University swimmer and Beijing Olympics gold medalist Cullen Jones, renowned women's swimming coach David Marsh, London Olympics gold medalist Ricky Behrens, and Gastonia resident and Barcelona Olympic Games gold medalist Mel Stewart. Braun's journey has been nothing short of amazing. She began her swimming career at age 12 and then went on to set high school, college, and national records in 50 freestyle. Then she quit swimming for 12 years before resuming her competitive swimming career in her early 30s and qualified for the 2012 U.S. Olympic trials at the age of 40. Braun tells Biz that she's currently training to compete at the 2016 Olympic trials in June. Love It or List It owners sue producers. Homeowners Dina Murphy and Timothy Sullivan have sued the producer and contractor involved in the renovation of their Raleigh home featured in the recent season of HGTV Network show Love It or List It. The defendants are Big Coat TV, producer of the show and party to a homeowner agreement with Murphy and Sullivan, and Aaron Fitz Construction, a North Carolina contractor hired to do the remodeling of their home at 7212 Catamount Court in North Raleigh. The lawsuit alleges that the homeowners paid Big Coat TV $151,400 for the remodeling work to be performed by Aaron Fitz Construction and its subcontractors. It also claims Big Coat TV only paid Aaron Fitz $85,786.80, and that Big Coat TV retained the remainder of the funds in the amount of $65,613.20. The complaint alleges breach of contract, negligent supervision resulting in faulty workmanship, unfair trade practices in violation of North Carolina's general contractor laws, and unauthorized retention of funds paid by the homeowners to Big Coat TV for the remodeling. Defendants say they intend to vigorously defend what they consider to be false allegations. Twitch, Thor, to headline women's show. The Southern Women's Show is returning to Raleigh, April 22 through 24 at the North Carolina State Fairgrounds. The annual event will showcase two new celebrity guests, Stephen Twitch Boss from The Ellen DeGeneres Show, as well as Whitney Way Thor from the TLC show My Big Fat Fabulous Life. Boss of So You Think You Can Dance fame also appeared in the 2015 movie Magic Mike XXL and will discuss his journey into acting and will show off some of his best dance moves. North Carolina native Thor will discuss her campaign for a positive body image, No Body Shame. The event will also feature the gospel queen of neo soul, Cynthia Jones, and authors Barbara Brufferman and Dwayna Litz. Dining Series picks Bull City for contest. The Got to Be NC competition Dining Series has added a new competition to its culinary battles this year. This food battle royale tournament kicks off in Durham with interactive dinner events April 18, 19, and 21. This series of all-star dream teams allows chefs from different restaurants to partner together on three-person teams, leading to a more delicious dishes. The Durham Bracket will include two preliminary showdowns and a final championship battle. Here is the scheduled lineup. April 18, Team Cocina from Chapel Hill versus Team Cucina from Southern Pines. April 19, Team Eggheads from Durham versus Team Garnish Nation from Warrington. And April 21, April 18 winner versus April 19 winner. Durham was one of our top choices for new locations to host the Got to Be NC Competition Dining Series battles during our 2016 season, said the competition's founder, Jimmy Crippen. And finally, in a section called He Said It, the quote, "I'm just tired of seeing our state bashed over bathrooms. I can't believe it. I mean, of all the good things we've got going on, to have this going on, well, it's just incomprehensible." And that's from O. Temple Sloan, Jr., Chairman, Highwoods Properties, Incorporated. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Amanda Hoyle. The first headline, $80 million project on tap in Chapel Hill. Northwood Raven, a North Carolina real estate development firm with projects across the Triangle, has closed on the purchase of 55 acres on Eubanks Road in Chapel Hill, where plans are being drawn for a new mixed-use project called Caraway Village. Caraway Village, better known still by its old name, The Edge, had in 2015 been approved by Chapel Hill Town Council for a special use permit to build up to 935,000 square feet of new multifamily, retail, and commercial building space, with as many as 23 vertically integrated low and mid-rise buildings. The project will be located near the intersection of Interstate 40 and Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. The more than $80 million Caraway Village project, though, still has some hills to climb before construction can begin, says Jeff Furman, director of Raleigh Operations for Northwood Raven. "We're still working with the town to ensure we can bring in attractive retail," he says. The firm has requested help from the town to pay for about $3.5 million in road, traffic signal, and infrastructure improvements around the site. Commercial property sales top $1 billion in first quarter 2016. The Triangle's commercial real estate capital markets in the first quarter of 2016 logged more than $1 billion in major property acquisition deals, a 56% increase compared to the year prior, according to a Triangle Business Journal study of local property sales. This year has so far been highlighted by the $187 million sale of the West Village apartment, retail, and office complex in downtown Durham in February, and the $103 million sale of the Sky House Raleigh apartment tower downtown in January. The volume of apartment, office, warehouse, and retail properties that transpired in March, however, totaled only $128 million, compared to more than triple that in both January and February. Local economists and real estate watchers aren't warning yet of a slowdown among national and international investors following a record-setting year in 2015, yet a recent Urban Land Institute economic forecast report is predicting a decline of property transaction volume nationally over the next 3 years. The latest ULI Real Estate Consensus Forecast, a semi-annual outlook, projects continued economic expansion over the next 3 years, but at a slower pace than the prior 2 years. Commercial real estate price appreciation will also continue to grow, but at slower rates of 5% growth in 2016, 2.7% pricing growth in 2017, and 3% growth in 2018. Home sales continuing to improve despite lack of inventory. Home buyers entering the Triangle housing market are finding fewer options than ever before in the Triangle as the inventory of new and existing homes continues to dwindle as demand continues to rise. Home sales rose 9% in the first quarter of 2016, according to Triangle Multiple Listing Service, with 6,882 home sales recorded in the 16-county coverage area. The number of available homes for sale in March had dropped to 8,422 units, or about 2.9-month supply of inventory. We certainly have some crazy things happening in our market, says Mark Parker, a managing broker at Fonville Morrissey Realty in Raleigh and president of the Raleigh Regional Association of Realtors. In short, we have many more buyers than we do sellers. Homes in the lower price point are selling extremely quickly, often within 24 to 48 hours with multiple offers, and go for over asking price. Part of the market dilemma, Parker says, is some potential sellers are afraid to list their home in fear of not having another home to relocate. I'm not sure how long we can sustain this kind of buying frenzy, but this may be the new normal for now, as we are in the peak of the home selling season, he says. Builders are building new homes as quick as they can, which will help, but it is not keeping pace with demand. And our final article on this page, rugged warehouse surrogate to open first store in Raleigh. The Gabe's Discount Fashion Chain, a big brother store to Rugged Warehouse, has signed a deal to open its first store in Raleigh at the North-South Station Shopping Center on Garner Station Boulevard. The new store in Raleigh will be among Gabe's largest locations in the Southeast, taking all of the nearly 86,000 square feet of vacant retail space remaining from when Walmart closed and relocated from the center in 2008. Mark Pitney, a broker at Latt Purser & Associates, who represents the owner of North South Station, confirmed the lease deal with Gabe's. Pitney says the new store is expected to open in the summer, but he referred all other questions to representatives of the Morganton, West Virginia-based retailer. A spokesman for Gabe's was unavailable for comment. The new store in Raleigh, though, could create between 100 and 170 new jobs based on past hiring events advertised for new stores that opened in Charlotte, Greensboro, and Gastonia in 2015. And now we turn to the On Pharmaceuticals page written by Jason DeBruin. The first headline, again, Durham's Viamet files to go public. Durham-based Viamet Pharmaceuticals has filed paperwork to complete an initial public offering. The drug developer flirted with a $75 million IPO in 2014, but instead raised $60 million in a private placement to continue developing antifungal treatments. Since inception, the company has raised $112 million. Private investors in Viamet include Malin J1 Limited, a group that counts former Glaxo Welcome CEO Bob Ingram as a board member, Durham-based groups Hatteras Venture Partners and Inner South Partners are also investors in the company, as are Novartis BioVentures and Lilly Ventures Fund, affiliated with Eli Lilly and Company. The company's lead investigational drug, VT-1161, is targeting two treatment areas, one for tonal fungus and one for vaginal yeast infections. In early March, Viamet reported positive results from two Phase 2b trials testing the experimental drug. Company CEO Robert Schatzinger did not immediately return an email seeking comment. The company's charter includes a poison pill that would effectively make a hostile takeover nearly impossible, something the company recognizes could limit the price that investors might be willing to pay in the future for shares of our common stock, thereby depressing the market price of our common stock, according to its filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Viamet applied for listing on the NASDAQ Global Market with proposed ticker symbol VMET. Drug tech could save millions for industry. Durham-based SciCon Innovation delivers to researchers and drug developers a technology that mimics human biology and provides an indication of how a new drug or therapy will behave in humans. This is important because it would allow early-stage biotech and pharmaceutical companies to test how their experimental treatment will react in humans without having to test it in a human or animal. The company has raised the majority of a $750,000 seed round and now has reached a development deal with InVitroQ, a Singapore-based in vitro cell-based assay services company. InVitroQ will expand the utility of Cycon's CyFlow 1000 system by developing infectious disease assays for the platform. The agreement expands Cycon's product offering outside the initial target markets of toxicology, drug metabolism, and oncology, and into the infectious diseases space. There is a significant unmet need in the global infectious disease market, says Cycon Chief Operating Officer Michael McCartney. Not only will our partnership with InVitroQ help us drive new revenue, it further validates the strength and flexibility of the CyFlow 1000 fluidic culture system. Cycon has grown from 2 full-time employees and 1 contractor in mid-2015 to 5 full-time staffers and 2 contract employees currently. It will look to hire 2 more positions this year. Precision Bio charts expansion path after inking deal that could bring $1.5 billion. Fresh off a deal that could ultimately be worth $1.6 billion, Durham-based Precision Biosciences will look to more than double its headcount this year. The company is hiring across all functional areas and expects that the team will grow from 35 to approximately 70 during 2016. The company has been on a steep growth curve. In 2015, the Duke University spinout raised more than $25 million from private investors, and in late February, inked a deal with Baxalta Incorporated that brought it $105 million up front. As part of the Baxalta agreement, the companies will collaborate to develop a broad series of therapies targeted at multiple types of cancers. In a best-case scenario, meaning if the companies can successfully commercialize cancer-fighting treatments, Precision could see another $1.5 billion come its way. That, of course, is many years in the future. The company occupies space in the Debrell Building in Durham. And now for a section called He Said It. The quote, "While difficult, these cost-saving measures are necessary. We are truly grateful for the meaningful contributions of the talented individuals impacted." And that is from Jeff Wolf, CEO of Durham drug developer Heat Biologics, after the company disclosed it would cut its workforce by 22%, cut compensation for the remaining leadership team, and reduce planned enrollment for a drug trial. The cost-cutting moves come as the company is running out of cash to continue drug development on its experimental cancer treatment. And finally, in a section called Big Numbers, $12 million spent by GlaxoSmithKline on direct-to-consumer advertising for Breo Ellipta in March, the second highest of any drug behind Humira, the anti-inflammatory manufactured by AbbVie. Breo is manufactured in Zebulon. 46 cents. Share price of Raleigh drug developer Nephrogenics, which was put on notice by NASDAQ that it faces a possible delisting. The company is searching for a partner with which to complete a reverse merger. And now we move over to the On Technology page, written by Lauren Onasorge. The first headline, Google grants $1 million to Group. Search engine giant Google is teaming up with Carrboro-based Miracle Feet, a small nonprofit trying to thwart Clubfoot, a disorder about 180,000 babies are born with each year. The technology firm has granted the group $1 million to continue its push to treat the condition across the globe. Miracle Feet executive director and co-founder, Cheska Coloretto Mansfield, got hooked on the issue when she learned that despite clubfoot being treatable without surgery, it remains one of the major causes of disability in the developing world, she says. "I became obsessed with this idea that these kids needed this treatment," she adds. Instead of just writing a check, Coloretto Mansfield decided to team up with others to create a nonprofit. Since its founding 6 years ago, the group has been working with local partners in developing countries, primarily healthcare providers, and making sure they're trained to treat clubfoot. Over the years, they've provided technology training and other services to more than 100 clinics in 13 countries, enrolling 15,000 kids in their programs. We're hoping to enroll 50,000 kids in 5 years, assuming we can raise the money, she says. The Carlborough nonprofit, which has 14 local employees, learned about the grant, coincidentally enough, by Googling, says Colorado Mansfield. While in California to receive an honor at the Tech Awards put on by the Tech Museum of Innovation, the team swung by Google to make their pitch in person. Launched in May of 2015, the Google Impact Challenge Disabilities is a $20 million project supporting nonprofits that use emerging technologies to create access and opportunity for people living with disabilities. Triangle execs weigh in on HB2 executive order. On April 12, Governor Pat McCrory issued an executive order to make some changes to the controversial House Bill 2, though it maintains the legislation's original stance on gender-specific restrooms. The executive order would expand the state's employment policy to cover sexual orientation and gender identity, and seek legislation to allow employees to sue their employers in state court over discrimination rather than federal court. Private companies could still make their own rules when it comes to discrimination, according to McCrory's office. Triangle Business Journal reached out to local execs for their thoughts on McCrory's executive order. I think he just put lipstick on a pig, says John Replogle, CEO of Seventh Generation on April 12. Replogle was one of dozens of CEOs across the country to petition against the measure when it was passed in special session in March. Replogle, whose sustainable household products company runs its venture arm from Raleigh, has said that HB2 may lead to his firm reevaluating investment opportunities in the state. When asked what he would have liked to have seen in McCrory's order, he said that he would repeal HB2 and apologize rather than call it misinformation. It is not easy to make a public declaration and then come back to try and move toward the middle, says Matt Williamson, CEO of Durham-based marketing technology firm Windsor Circle. What he and many conservative lawmakers are misreading is that businesses have largely evolved on this social issue and care more about finding and securing the best talent than where that talent chooses to use the bathroom. And in a section called By the Numbers, Lenovo maintains top slot despite weak PC sales. While PC sales across the globe continued to decline in the first quarter of 2016, a pair of dueling research firms find Lenovo, which claims Morrisville as a dual headquarters, dominating the field. Gartner and IDC, which released reports April 11, found worldwide PC shipments declined 9.6% and 11.5% respectively, but both reports put Lenovo at the head of the global PC pack, followed by HP and Dell. IDC had Apple in the number 4 slot. And in a section called He Said It, the quote, "You've got this emerging generation of millennials who want to be able to do everything mobile and social. We have to be able to deliver those services through the technology they want to use, and that technology is not cheap." That's a quote from Chuck Purvis, CEO of Raleigh-based Coastal Federal Credit Union, speaking after his company announced it would be acquiring Rocky Mount-based Freedom Credit Union. And as we continue reading in the Triangle Business Journal, there are more stories on technology. The next headline, sources, Red Hat to bet on Boston for large tech center. While Red Hat remains mum on the topic, real estate sources in Boston confirm the open source technology giant is expanding again, just not in Raleigh. They say a Boston expansion, which will include an executive briefing center, is a recruitment move and is unrelated to North Carolina's controversial House Bill 2. But CEO Jim Whitehurst has made no secret of the fact that he's adamantly against the measure, calling the bill a clear step backwards in a March 23 tweet. Politics or no politics, it would not be the first time Red Hat has chosen to expand in Boston over Raleigh. In 2012, the company announced it was doubling its Massachusetts presence with the construction of a 100,000-square-foot facility in Westford. Both Raleigh and Mountain View, California, were under consideration for that expansion. Paul Cormier, president of products and technologies at the open-source software company, said at the time that a combination of talent pool and incentives led to the decision to park in Westford. The state of Massachusetts approved $3.4 million in tax credits. The company, which crossed the $2 billion mark in annual revenue last year, has said repeatedly that it plans to grow this year across its entire operation. Red Hat executive said in a recent earnings call that the plan is to add 1,400 employees in the fiscal year, a 16% increase in headcount. The company has not been specific about how many of those jobs will come to Raleigh, where it decided in 2011 to invest $109 million in its world headquarters in exchange for $15 million in incentives. And it's not making any official statement about its plans for Boston, where it bases its engineering operation. As a general rule, Red Hat does not comment on rumors or speculation, the company said in a statement. However, as a growing company, we are always evaluating our options, both existing and otherwise, for space that supports our needs. Hire Hungry, Distill Networks expands Raleigh ops. Firm chooses Charter Square to house new jobs. Rami Asaid, the San Francisco-based CEO of fast-growing IT security firm Distill Networks, has big plans for Raleigh. His company, founded by a group of entrepreneurs from Cary, all NC State University grads, recently confirmed it was expanding into Charter Square in downtown Raleigh, having already outgrown the space it just moved into on Fayetteville Street. Bots are a platform to do any kind of good or bad thing you want, Distill's Asaid has said. His firm, which is expanding in Raleigh, aims to stop bots. They quite literally help amplify anything a hacker can dream of, so stopping them and identifying all the bad ones is just good security hygiene. Already, nearly 20 Distill employees are working in the Triangle, primarily in engineering roles. It's a huge uptick from 2 years ago when the Raleigh team consisted of 4 employees. And Asaid says there are plans in place to double the current headcount in the next 2 years. The company has committed to enough space in Charter Square to house about 70 employees, but one piece of legislation may stand in the way of that growth, House Bill 2. The controversial measure caught his attention, and as his company continues to recruit engineers to Raleigh, he sees the law as a roadblock. I've had 3 employees move to North Carolina, and this doesn't jive well with them, he says. I think the big thing for us is it positions North Carolina as a much less hospitable place to relocate to. Right now, he's planning that bullish growth trajectory, but he's watching the legislature, he says. If North Carolina continues this way, I think it will really influence us, he says. It's disappointing. Being a Raleigh boy, it's really disappointing to me. Distill Networks, which was founded in Washington, D.C., has 120 employees across the company. And in a section called He Said It, the quote, "We needed that proof point in order to unlock a new round of funding, but also the next phase of the business." And that's a quote from David Shaner, CEO of Offline Media, on why his company expanded from Raleigh to Charlotte and Nashville. The firm just raised more than $700,000 in new financing from the likes of former iContact CEO Ryan Allis. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Executive Voice article, and this one focuses on Mary Dell Chilton. The headline, "How Chemistry Trumped Astronomy for Her. Chilton fell in love with science after some near misses early in her career." And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. No one tells Syngenta scientist Mary Dell Chilton what she can and cannot do. It's a lesson a college professor may have learned in hindsight decades ago, as he saw Chilton, later considered by many to be the inventor of modern plant science, storm out of his office and never return. "I think about that sometimes," she said, years later in the building named for her at Syngenta's Research Triangle Park-based campus. The story starts in North Carolina. As a 10-year-old child living with her grandparents in Southern Pines, someone, I don't remember who, she says, gave her a copy of Astronomy with an Opera Glass. It explained star phenomena, what you could see, she recalls. I'd get out in the backyard with binoculars and my book and find things. It was more about looking at pretty things than science, she says. In seventh grade, she moved to Chicago with her parents, and it was there in high school where her interest in science would really evolve. No one really told her to like science. She claims no mentors pushed her on her path and says the fact that women face discriminatory obstacles in the field never occurred to her. It was just really interesting, she says. But the odds were stacked against her. Until eighth grade, she had never had a science class, unlike her peers who came out of urban junior high schools. Chilton had to work from the ground up, taking a remedial science course as a freshman called General Science. The teacher told her she did so well in her science aptitude test that they didn't believe it. They thought I must have cheated. That teacher, who taught her biology, chemistry, and physics, told her to consider science as a career. The fact that there weren't a lot of girls in calculus club never really crossed my mind. The fact that anyone might ever think differently of her because she was a girl? Nope, never thought about it, she says. But what she was thinking about was that astronomy book. In her downtime, she was an amateur telescope maker. The Adler Planetarium in Chicago had a program that taught kids to make simple telescope mirrors. So she got a kit and a telescope book and started rounding her own mirror while other kids were at football and cheerleading practice. It's precise work, precision that prepared her for her future in a laboratory. You work on it for 20 minutes, then test it. Work on it for 20 minutes and then test it, she says. You don't want a sphere, you want a parabola. And when she finished the simple telescope, she moved on to more complex telescope creations. And she could have even taken it further. In college at the University of Illinois, she fully intended to take astronomy. She had placed out of calculus and rhetoric and approached the professor. He said, you had to be a sophomore to take astronomy, she recalls, smirking at the way he told her she'd need more calculus to understand his class. I got mad and I stormed out of there. I decided to hell with it. They didn't want me and I didn't want them. She never did take astronomy. But after falling asleep in a few physics lectures, she did take chemistry, a field that would send her on her current path. It was through that spectrum of science that would send her on a genetics project that, while she was trying to prove something couldn't happen, ended up helping to develop the first genetically engineered plant. And it may all be thanks to that snarky astronomy professor. Had he let her into that class, it might have been different, she says. And now we go back to the viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal to read the guest opinion. The guest opinion is by James Kane, a Raleigh resident and former U.S. ambassador to Denmark. The headline, Brussels Terror Demands Sobering Look. Two Saturdays ago, just outside Maastricht, the Netherlands, I visited the 65-acre American cemetery in Margraten. A sea of marble white crosses and stars of David is arrayed in a gentle arc marking the final resting place of 8,301 American soldiers who fell nearby while ensuring the liberty and security of a Europe brutalized by World War II. My wife Helen, our daughters Cameron and Laura, and a few friends and I were there to view the magnificent array of flowers brought to the cemetery the day before. The flowers came from funerals of Alexander and Sasha Penchowski, Dutch siblings who lived in New York and were murdered on March 22 in the Brussels airport by Islamist terrorists Ibrahim El Bakrou and Najim Lakarou. Alex was married to our daughter Cameron. He was an exceptionally clever student of international relations and possessed a keen curiosity about the world. Alex and I talked about the deliverance of Europe from the evils of Nazism, including his family's hometown of Maastricht. We didn't always see eye to eye on politics, but Alex and I agreed that the Allies' success in 1944 had some essential requisites. Those included the ability to coordinate an effort against a poisonous ideology, the willpower of free people from non-captive nations to commit to fighting a common enemy, and the presence of resolute leadership, which could only come, as that point, at that point, from America. As I stood before the dozens of bouquets at the cemetery, I pondered whether, with an enemy of a type different in this century, America today was still willing to fulfill the leadership role that once brought peace and freedom to the world. And are the countries affected by this modern war, which includes many of the same nations ravaged by World War II, willing to take this fight seriously? Our own experience in Brussels, while frantically searching for Alex and Sasha, gave reasons for doubt. At Astrid Military Hospital, where Cameron, Helen, and I, along with Marjan and Ed Pinkowski, Alex and Sasha's parents, coordinated our search, Belgian crisis management capability could only be described as disheartening. It was rife with misinformation, confusion, and a seeming callous disregard for the sentiments of the frantically searching families. But more painful than the botched crisis management is the knowledge that this tragic event shouldn't have happened at all. We have learned that the Belgian authorities had advanced knowledge of the affiliations and intentions of Najim Lakhraou, Ibrahim El Brakraou, and his brother Khalid, the suicide bomber who struck the Brussels subway. They were serious criminals who had served prison time. The FBI, the New York City police, and Turkish intelligence reportedly had informed the Belgians that these men were suspected terrorists. They had visited Syria and had Islamic State sympathies. They were known associates of the mastermind of the Paris attacks in November, yet the Belgian authorities failed to act. Belgium has been described as the closest thing Western Europe has to a failed state. Its neighborhoods, including those in which the murderers grew up, are breeding grounds for Islamist extremism. Multiple agencies have overlapping and inconsistent jurisdiction and refuse to share intelligence. The Belgian authorities clearly have been unable to ensure their own national security or that of visitors to their country. How ironic that NATO and the European Union have headquarters in Brussels. Let's be clear, this fight is not only against America and Europe, and it is not against Christianity. It is a fight against individualism, reason, and independence of thought that began during the Enlightenment over 350 years ago in France and found its greatest expression in the grand experiment launched by our founding fathers in Philadelphia. This freedom is now under attack by the henchmen of the Dark Ages, wherever they detect it, from Paris to Pakistan, San Bernardino to Istanbul, Nairobi to Brussels. Those who embrace this freedom in what was once permissible to call the civilized world are awakening to the battle lines that are forming. And like the battles that liberated Europe 70 years ago, the civilized world now demands coordination, willpower, and leadership. And now we move to the People on the Move page. The spotlight is on Chris Budnick, Executive Director of Healing Transitions. Having worked in the addiction treatment and recovery field for more than two decades, Chris Budnick has taken the next step in his quest by being named Executive Director of Raleigh-based Addiction Treatment Center Healing Transitions, formerly known as the Healing Place of Wake County. Budnick had been employed by Healing Transitions International since 2000, most recently serving as Vice President of Programs. In that role, he oversaw the operations for Healing Transitions' 180-bed men's campus and 99-bed women's campus. As executive director, Budnick is responsible for what he refers to as fidelity to its mission, sustainability of the organization, and replication of the model in other communities. This involves making sure that we adhere to our guiding principles while being responsive to the growing and frequently changing needs of the community, he adds. Budnick will also continue to lead the organization's expansion efforts in Greenville and Wilmington. Healing Transitions employs about 50 people and is billed as a community-driven response to the problems of homelessness and substance use disorders. In 2015, the organization served 1,770 unique individuals, including those seeking shelter, those in need of detox services, and those in its recovery program. Healing Transitions reported revenue of $3.7 million in its latest 990 tax filing. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? I wish people knew that addiction recovery is attainable, There is hope for addiction recovery, and it truly benefits everyone. What are some of your major goals for your new position? I strive to better serve the community and those seeking addiction recovery by providing services to help more people get in recovery, stay in recovery, and have the best quality of life in recovery. Biggest pet peeve? My biggest pet peeve is when schools, employers, and the community limit someone's potential by only looking at their past. Triangle area business person you most admire. Gypsy Gilliam, who runs the State Farmers Market restaurant. She's willing to give people a second chance and employ those in recovery despite their background. Last book read, Stigma, Notes of the Management of Spoiled Identity by Irving Goffman. And with the remaining time we have, we'll read as much of this article as we can. The headline, Building Trust in Virtual Teams for a Common Cause. And this article is written by Edward Marshall, who is a senior partner for organizational leadership at the Center for Creative Leadership in Greensboro. Our business world is increasingly virtual. No matter what size your enterprise, we work within all kinds of teams, often without ever physically meeting each other. To be successful, we need to build a high level of trust, which is difficult to do without working face-to-face. Email is a poor substitute. Only 10% of effective communications are written, and more than 70% of our communication with others is nonverbal. We need to see and hear each other to understand facial expressions, tones, attitudes, meaning, inflection, and nuance. So the challenge is how we have effective communications when much of the time we cannot see each other. Virtual video conferencing is a potential alternative if it is done well. All virtual visual communications, however, are not created equal. For maximum effectiveness in building trust, here are some success factors. Virtual technology. With the advent of Cisco telepresence, GoToMeeting, Skype, and other ways to see and talk with people across the community, country, or around the world, we have learned that the type of technology makes a significant difference. And actually, we're going to stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.